We interrupt to bring you this.
You've connected with a worldwide network of millions. You're on TalkZone.com, Internet Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. I'm Hub Arkish, along with my co-hosts Jimmy Clemens and Mike Wilkening. It's our pleasure to welcome you to this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News, where every week we bring you all the news, scoops, and rumors before they happen from the NFL, the NBA, and college hoops as well.
We take a closer look at the feeble New Jersey Nets and a couple of quarterback shakeups in the NFC West.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.
Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. I'm Hub Arkish, the publisher and editor, along with senior editor Mike Wilkening. Of course, our co-host every week during the basketball season is Jim Clemens of the L.A. Lakers. And we are joined by our favorite guest, our regular guest, the number one NBA and college hoops insider in the country. Steve Kyler is the publisher of HoopsWorld.com. And, guys, we're in the second round of the NBA playoffs. It gets a lot more interesting now. And as we tape late in the week, every series has shown us, well, some things to talk about. And, Jimmy, we're going to start with yours. Your ball club gets the first two at home. Kobe certainly seems to be a little more energized than he was in that first series against Oklahoma City. Now, I'm not saying he's more energized, but he just looks healthier. He looks better. And as a result, your team seems to be playing a little better chemistry.
Well, we're playing better, and maybe it is the little bit of rest that he got, I would say, between series, but actually that was only a day. I think he understands the importance of it, Hub, and he's putting more energy into it, and we're fortunate to have a little bit of a break between games two and three. But as a whole, we've won two games, but we certainly aren't pleased with the way we're playing. We're mounting nice little leads, and then within the next two or three minutes, we're turning around, and Utah's finding a surge of energy that is depleting that. So we have to realize that when we go to Utah this weekend, we certainly need to play much better.
You know, Steve, I'm curious if you've ever spoken to anyone in the league office about this, because the NBA playoffs, more than any, puzzle me with the scheduling. The 3-day break for the Lakers-Jazz series, the 3-day break for the Celtics and the Cavs, it seems like they almost drag this out at the risk of some of these teams losing momentum and chemistry. Is there any thought, or do you have any idea as to why they put these long breaks between games?
Well, a lot of it is about putting especially these semi-conference finals matchups in prime time. You know, the television contract, like all thing in sports, kind of wags the dog. I think there's an expression that the downfall of the sport started the first time we stopped to take a timeout for a commercial. And, you know, the truth of the matter is everyone has made their money on the TV contracts. The TV contracts dictate a lot of things, especially in the postseason. And, you know, these matchups, these huge marquee matchups in the second round and the conference finals round, that's primetime television. And, you know, it's about trying to get as many games on at 8 o'clock Eastern as you can. And, you know, if that means somebody has an extra day off or some teams lose a little bit of momentum, that's the cost of doing business.
Steve, under the best of circumstances, the Lakers may be a little too long at the 3, 4, and 5 for the Jazz, but with the Jazz bigs all banged up, and I know they're such a different team on the road than they are at home, but is that, to your mind, too much of a disadvantage for Utah in this series?
Well, I think the length is an issue, but, you know, the other part of it is, and like you said, Hub, they have not been a good road team. They haven't been a good road team, really, with this core group for 4 or 5 years. They play differently at home, and I think that that's going to be a little bit for them. But, you know, Utah is not a team that's going to overwhelm you. They're going to play very methodical basketball. They've got a game plan that they're going to execute, and they hope you'll make some mistakes and you'll let up. And, you know, as Coach said, you know, the game two, it wasn't about trying to put on a huge run. It was just trying to hang around and hope you could get a couple of possessions here and there. And that's Utah Jazz basketball. It's not very sexy. And I think that, you know, as long as the Lakers stay focused in what they're doing, they have all the tools to win this series. And Hub, like you said, with the injuries and everything, Utah's playing at a disadvantage. They're just hoping you'll make more mistakes than they did.
Jimmy, Utah's certainly a very different basketball team style-wise from the Oklahoma City Thunder, who, at least through the first four, gave you guys a pretty good scare. What type of adjustments do you guys make right off the bat to switch to a style like Utah's?
Well, we know that Utah is going to force us to execute. As Steve stated earlier, they are a very methodical team, and if you do not execute and match their execution, actually at both ends of the floor, not only offensively but also defensively, you're in for a long evening. So that's one of the things that we definitely must do. And on the second part of that, Utah runs the ball very effectively and efficiently the first and the third quarters. So the OKC series actually helped our transition defense because we know that we have to get back because they will push the ball down at you the first and third quarters, and the second and fourth quarters they usually go to more of their sets and pound the ball inside to Boozer and Millsap these days, and so we know that our game must be on point to finish this season out or this series out in the right way.
Steve, you know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this last night, and while the Lakers and the Cavaliers, at least going in, may have been the favorites, in the Final Eight, they're really the only two teams that don't have a dominant point guard. And some would argue it's become a point guard league. Does Deron Williams have to be the difference in this series for Utah to have a chance?
Yeah, and he was really the difference in the first series with them, too. This is a team that goes as Deron takes them. You know, as good as Carlos is, he's not nearly a take-over-the-game player. You know, Paul Millsap is very good. They've got a lot of good complementary players. But if Deron Williams isn't giving them, you know, 25, 30 points a night, they're a very beatable team. And, you know, the only way the Jazz is going to roll through you is through Deron Williams. And, you know, I think they're comfortable with that. I think they're fine with that. And when you, you know, look at the player Deron Williams has become, I think he's fine with that. But, you know, a big thing of it is when you become very one-dimensional, when there is a key focal point player at this level in the playoffs, pretty easy to derail you with some good defense and some double teams. You know, the Cavaliers are running into that with LeBron James, and I think, you know, to a certain extent, Utah's running into that with Deron Williams.
All right, guys, we take a quick breather here. When we come back, Spurs-Suns out west as well, and a look at some pretty big-time coaching openings in the NBA. All of that just ahead. Back with more NBA insider information right here on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. I'm Hub Arkus, Jimmy Clemens, Mike Wilkening alongside Steve Kyler, the publisher of HoopsWorld.com, is with us as well. And guys, Spurs, Suns, I talked about at the back of that last segment, it's become a point guards league. And anybody who watched their game one, Steve Nash was unconscious. Tony Parker trying to get healthy, not in the starting lineup. I think we all assume he's in the starting lineup as quickly as possible, possibly already, since we're taping late in the week. And Steve, is that the key matchup in this series?
Well, it certainly was in game one. I mean, Greg Popovich talked a lot about it in post game that, you know, Steve came out and put the pedal down and forced the tempo and really set them up in a nice cushion for the game. And really the Suns didn't make a lot of mistakes. And, you know, Popovich was very concerned about transition defense. You know, the Spurs are not a team that's going to beat you out in a foot race. And the Suns want to keep the tempo up. And, you know, I think those are adjustments the Spurs are ready to make. You know, this is a team that tends to respond well after having a bad game, and I think they're going to make a series out of this. But at the same time, you have to give it to Steve Nash and the Suns. They had a very good game plan. They played very good defense in that opening game, and we'll see how this thing plays out.
Hey, Jimmy, you've been coaching in the NBA a long time. You know, I think everybody aspires to the head job and then one of the top assistants jobs. You've got one of the top assistants jobs in the league. But we look around and we see suddenly the Philadelphia 76ers in the fourth biggest market in the league, the Chicago Bulls in the third biggest market in the league, head coaching openings, very high profile, kind of an ugly divorce in Chicago with Vinny Del Negro. What's the buzz amongst coaches around the league as far as what went on in Chicago? Was damage done to the image of that franchise? Is that still a premier destination, or is this just life in the big time and no problem, you know, people are going to line up for that job?
From where I sit, I think that people still would be very much interested in the job as you look around and the talent that they have, and even they have been somewhat dysfunctional for whatever reasons the last couple of years, but they still managed to be one of the top eight teams in the Eastern Conference. So they're doing something right. There's talent there, so I don't see why people would be fearful of the job.
Steve, Doug Collins appears to be in the catbird seat right now. He's already interviewed in Philadelphia, as of this taping, hasn't taken the job. He is rumored to be one of the top candidates in Chicago. He was a top candidate 2 years ago when Del Negro was hired, and Collins didn't get the job for the bizarre reason that Jerry Reinsdorf said he didn't want to have to worry about having to fire him a second time because they're such good friends. I mean, is Doug Collins going to drive this whole coaching search in both cities, or are there other candidates we should be talking about?
Well, in Chicago, they've made it very clear that they're not going to be narrow. You know, Gar Forman was really clear in saying we're not going to put the coaching search in a box and say it has to be this and it has to be that. I think the one thing Gar wants to do, because this really is going to be a Gar Forman hire, is he wants to make sure he's talked to everybody and wants to make sure that he's got a coach that he's willing to maybe risk his job on. And to a certain extent, I think that's what Ed Stefanski's going through with Philadelphia 76ers. You know, he bet on Eddie Jordan last year and it went bad, and now they're going to be paying him for a couple of years. So I think both Gar and Ed Stefanski, to a certain extent, need to be very thorough in this. And the one thing about Doug Collins is he's a proven. You know exactly what you're going to get out of Doug. You know, you know that he knows the right guys to bring in, and an assistant coach and a training capacity. You've got some history in what his offensive and defensive philosophies are, and they're sound and they're fundamental. So I think from a Doug Collins point of view, he's kind of a very safe hire. But I think all the teams involved, too, want to try to maybe find the next stud, which is why they're talking to guys like Avery Johnson. They're willing to look at assistants like, you know, Ty Corbin and Monty Williams. And I think that there's going to be a long, protracted search, I think, because there are so many teams. You've got New Orleans that's looking for a head coach. You've got New Jersey that's looking for a head coach. The way the Atlanta Hawks have played, they may be looking for a head coach. And, you know, if Cleveland gets bounced early, they could be looking for a head coach. So there's a lot of teams that are going to be looking at guys. And I agree with you. I think Doug Collins is a very popular name right now, but I think Avery Johnson's going to get a lot of looks. I think Byron Scott's going to get a lot of looks. And, you know, I think even Sam Mitchell's going to get some looks. So I think there are a number of names in play right now. I think it's a little too early to say that there's a favorite, but Doug seems to be the name on everybody's list.
Jimmy, I'm curious, and I'm guessing this is a source of some minor frustration to you, but in the NBA, more than any other sport, as soon as people make a list, here we go, Doug Collins, Eric Musselman, Byron Scott, Mo Cheeks, Avery Johnson, all guys who've tried and failed usually multiple times, and yet the hot young assistants, it seems, or any hot assistant, doesn't seem to get a chance. In the NFL, the trend is the opposite. Everybody wants the hot assistant rather than the veteran coach who's failed. Major League Baseball, you have managers you've never heard of. Why is it so much harder in the NBA for an assistant coach to make the leap as opposed to them recycling these guys two, three, four times?
I think it's a known quantity, and people are afraid, as Steve said earlier, they're afraid to put their jobs and reputations on the line, so they go what they think is the safe route. But once again, how many times does a guy have to fail before sooner or later he's going to have some success if he's any good at all, and the guys have to keep, you know, reshuffling the deck, and you end up sometimes right where you started at the end of the line.
All right, guys, we take another break here. Steve Kyler, publisher at HoopsWorld.com. Get there 24-7 for the best in NBA inside news. Steve, enjoy the playoffs. We'll be back with Jimmy and Wilkie in just a moment. Welcome back, everybody. Hub Arkish, Jimmy Clemens, Mike Wilkening, bringing you Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News, and we are delighted this segment to be joined by Tom Withers. And Tom, outstanding sports writer and columnist for the Associated Press, covers a lot of the Cleveland area teams and the Cavs in particular. And, Tom, coming out of game two, I gotta believe that there was a bit of wailing and gnashing of teeth in Cleveland, a little concern. I know the coach had some concerns. What's the attitude like amongst the fans right now?
There's always wailing and gnashing of teeth in Cleveland. This is Cleveland. They haven't had, as you know, a pro sports championship here since 1964. So, yeah, it's turned into the elbow watch here. You know, everybody's quite concerned about LeBron James's elbow, which is clearly bothering him as much as the team wants to dismiss it and LeBron wants to downplay it. It is clearly having a factor on his game. He was not nearly as aggressive as he normally is in game two of the series. And, you know, he's standing around and watching his teammates when it's usually the other way around. So that's the big news here, is keeping an eye on that elbow.
Tom, I'm in Los Angeles, and obviously the elbow watch is here also, but I can't find any definition as what's actually wrong with the elbow.
Well, Clem, he's had now at least two MRIs that we know of, and he's expected to have a third one later this week. It has been diagnosed as a ligament strain as well as a bone bruise. Now, you know, that's what the team is telling us, so we have to go by that at this point. It is clearly bothering him from the aspect that he does not quite have the same zip on his passes. You know, one of LeBron's signature moves is that windmill dunk, and we haven't seen that yet. He's had a couple breakaways where he's basically calmly just kind of set the ball down. You know, that's something that the team kind of feeds off of, and the crowd at the Quicken Loans Arena does as well. So we haven't seen that. And, you know, he's rubbing it. You know, you can tell that it's bothering him. I don't know if he's able to flex it like he normally can. He's taken three outside shots in the first quarter. I'm sorry, in the first half of the first two games. Seems to be saving himself for the fourth quarter. You know, Mo Williams' performance in game one was able, you know, he kind of carried them through. He had a magnificent third quarter, hit a bunch of shots, had the dunk over Paul Pierce. And LeBron, you know, was able to kind of bide his time and then turn it on in the fourth quarter when he needed to. Well, when he needed to turn it on the other night, you know, the Celtics were already up by 25 points and it was already too late. So, I'm not a doctor, but I know enough to know, and I've seen LeBron for 10 years now. I happened to cover him in high school, so I've never seen him be quite as passive as he's been on the floor the last two games.
Tom, give us your assessment of what Shaquille O'Neal's been able to do, and how much of an impact do you think he's going to have the rest of the way?
Well, he better have an impact, or the Cavs are in a real uphill battle. You know, we all wondered what it would be like for the Cavs to try to have to integrate him back into the rotation, because he missed, I guess, about 25 games or so after he tore the thumb ligament against the Celtics back in February. So he's really had no impact at all. You know, other than a hard foul on Rondo at the end of game one, he really, you know, he's got a presence obviously alone just by being in the paint and forcing the Celtics, you know, maybe to play on the perimeter a little bit more. But offensively, he's really struggled. They've force fed him the ball a little bit to try to get him going, and he has really had no lift at all getting off the floor. Has missed a lot of bunny shots that you would hope would go down, and you kind of wonder how much that thumb might still be bothering him, because, you know, while he doesn't have the greatest touch in the world, you know, a lot of these balls are kind of spinning out and you don't know if he's overcompensating with the right thumb or not. So, you know, for the Cavs to advance, they're going to need either at this point, you know, assuming that James' elbow is still going to be an issue, they're going to need Antoine Jameson and or Shaq to really deliver a big game in the next couple, especially game three is going to determine this entire series.
Well, and Tom, before we let you go, that leads me to, I guess, what is kind of the final, it's kind of a two-part question, but as Michael Jordan proved in Chicago, and we've seen with LeBron in Cleveland, until Mo Williams, Delonte West, Antoine Jameson, Shaq are ready to be primetime players themselves, I understand that LeBron James is the defending two-time MVP, but he's not going to win a championship by himself. And so the question is this team good enough? And what is there to project that even if they get by Boston, that they can handle Orlando? That's part one. And then part two, and if they don't at least get to the finals, what impact does that have on LeBron James staying in Cleveland after this year?
Well, it would certainly have some. Obviously, that's the big elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about. You know, what is the future? I don't think LeBron knows quite yet. I think LeBron is waiting for, you know, the next few weeks to play out and see how things unfold. You know, to your point about the Magic, I think people keep forgetting that that's the Eastern Conference Championship team. I mean, that's a team that stood in the way of the Cavs last year. Oh, and by the way, beat them without a healthy Jameer Nelson. So, you know, that's still going to be, you know, quite an obstacle if the Cavs are able to get past the Celtics. You know, in terms of if they don't get to the finals, if they don't get as far as they did last year, you know, clearly, you know, the scrutiny will come on Mike Brown even more so than it did last year after they lost to the Magic in six games. And clearly LeBron then would have to, you know, rethink his future. You know, is this team built for a championship run? You know, should they not win, you know, then what happens to Shaq? Do they not re-sign him? You know, what other changes might be on the way? So, you know, to your point as well, you know, Michael wouldn't have done it without Pippen and Rodman and Horace Grant and John Paxson and a cast of others. And LeBron has been waiting for these guys to step up, and, boy, now's the time for them to do it.
Tom Withers, thank you so much. Tom covers the Cleveland Cavaliers for the Associated Press. We need to take a quick commercial break, and we're back with more Pro Football Weekly basketball news in a moment. We are back. Jim Clemens, Mike Wilkening, I'm Hub Arkish, and let's talk just a little bit more about the Celtics and the Cavs, because, Jimmy, what we didn't get into with Tom is the resurgent Boston Celtics. They were very impressive in round one. Everybody wrote them off as too old, too slow, too banged up. They're giving Cleveland all they can handle, and people forget it was just 2 years ago they won an NBA title. Are we overlooking this basketball team?
Well, the thing is that when you play your regular season, you have sometimes, you know, back-to-backs, a day off, and another set of back-to-backs. But in playoff basketball, you have rest in between. And the Celtics, Yes, they're older, they're more mature, they are banged up, but those days in between, they're nursing their injuries and their egos and their mindsets, and they're getting prepared to go to battle game time, and that's where playoff basketball and their experience and their ability to have been there and done that is going to come into play. They're not going to fold, much like in our series out here with Utah. They're going to be there when the dust settles, and Cleveland's going to have to put them away, and that's the question mark right now. Game threes and four in Boston are going to be maybe classics.
Well, Mike, we talk about teams flying under the radar, and as we just talked with Tom Withers of the AP last segment, the Orlando Magic are the defending Eastern Conference champs, not the Cleveland Cavaliers, not LeBron James. They also have been the most impressive team in these playoffs so far by a long shot. Now, granted, they got a Charlotte team that wasn't ready for primetime, but then they come out in Game 1 and just destroy the Hawks. Hawks may have been a little bit tired, but there don't appear to be any chinks in the Magic's armor right now, and I'm not sure why they're not the favorite at this point.
You know, Hub, I'd have to agree with you. I think right now they look like the strongest team in the East. They have moved through these playoffs with absolute ease. And the way Dwight Howard played in the opener, 21 points and 12 rebounds, seemed to get back into rhythm. You know, everything was hitting on all cylinders for them in the opener. And you look at the way they've played Atlanta all season. Atlanta has really struggled with them. And I tend to think that when you look at this, Atlanta is going to have to change some things very quickly and really reverse form from how they've played Orlando here to have a chance. I think to come out that flat 48 hours after a game seven is not a good sign. Sure, tired legs kind of come into the equation, but you would have thought that maybe they would have mustered a better effort. To be blown out that way, I think, you know, to me, doesn't augur particularly well for Atlanta, and I think it says, perhaps more than anything else, how good Orlando is.
Jimmy, I understand that ones and threes and fives all have a different kind of an impact on a game and on their team, but is Dwight Howard the dominant, at least interior player in the game right now?
I would say so. I'm very surprised that I understand LeBron getting the MVP, but I do not understand how Dwight Howard wasn't second. If you look at his quote-unquote body of work the last couple of years, I would think that in any other sport, he would have won or certainly been in the same conversation. He's quite a talent, and his day will come, and he just has to be patient. I think, once again, if they're as serious as they were last June in trying to, quote-unquote, get back and make sure that they make amends for their performance last year, because that's all they talked about, they're certainly a team on a mission, and anyone that overlooks them or takes them for granted, I think they're in for shock.
All right, Jimmy, listen, you take a little bit of a rest here with 3 days. We've got the weekend in Utah for you. Good luck with the Lakers. We take a quick commercial break here, and we're back with NFL Way We Hear It in just a moment. We roll on with Pro Football Weekly and basketball news, and we do focus on the gridiron now with NFL Way We Hear It. If there are dog days of an NFL season with the draft now behind us, and June 1st not really meaning that much in free agency anymore. The cuts that needed to be made to the high-priced veterans came over the draft weekend. We talk about developments in minicamps, and we welcome in senior editor Eric Edholm. And in Philadelphia, and I don't know whether this is an official minicamp or OTAs or whatever it is, but they've got veterans on the field together. And huge, huge turnover with that football team, Eric, right now. And best case, obviously, looking for leaders on both sides of the ball. And it would appear that Asante Samuel is not likely to be the first choice on defense based on his recent performance.
I think this offseason one of the biggest criticisms of him was that he's been called out for his tackling ability. He also tends to freelance a lot, sort of do what he wants. And Sean McDermott had sort of a damning quote earlier in the offseason about this. Well, you know, of course, the Philadelphia beat writers and here us here at Pro Football Weekly, if you pick up our preview, you're going to see what I wrote about his tackling ability. But a lot of people have called this out based on the film they've seen from last season. And Samuel was beside himself, I guess, reading this stuff and chewing out a local reporter, spending the entire practice mouthing to this guy while practice was going on. So I think a lot of people realize that this is a sign of serious immaturity. You know, this guy's got a big money contract. You know, I think this obviously could have been handled a lot differently and a lot better. But, you know, beside him are a ton of new players on defense. They're going to really need that cohesion for Sean McDermott, the coordinator.
Well, and you know, Eric, it's interesting. A ton of new players, many of whom many insiders feel were overdrafted a little bit. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not going to be great football players, but Brandon Graham, not sure they had to go up as high as they did and give up as much as they did to draft him. They've let some veterans move on. They've traded Chris Gokong, who was a guy who used to step in big time for him at linebacker. You can't tell the players without a scorecard over there right now, and you're hearing that Sean McDermott is also using them all in multiple positions.
Yeah, it's going to look like a Swiss Army knife defense. You're going to see guys, you know, defensive end lined up at linebacker, linebackers end up at defensive ends kicking into defensive tackle. That's not really new for them, but this other stuff, this experimentation, corners playing safety, Nate Allen, the second-round pick, who a lot of people thought could challenge a free safety, he's being used at multiple spots, nickel corner, inside, at free safety as well. So they're looking for combinations. I think the term starter may not hold a lot of value because so many different guys, including nine draft picks, are going to play big roles in this defense, it appears.
Well, and another team you cover, and of course a nemesis of the Philadelphia Eagles, the Dallas Cowboys, news coming out of Irving, Texas all week long. Dez Bryant, who dropped down into the 20s where Jerry Jones finally traded up to get him, couldn't let it pass. A lot of questions circulating around him off the field, not so much on the field, although he didn't work out nearly as well for scouts and coaches prior to the draft as people expected. Wade Phillips, you give the quote because I still can't believe I heard it, but Wade Phillips apparently thinks he's the best thing since baked bread.
Right. I mean, Phillips, after the conclusion of their three-day rookie camp, said he's about as good a looking player as he's seen after 3 days of camp. Now, again, what he's saying is, hey, you know, it's still really early. You know, we weren't throwing on the pads and making hits and that sort of stuff. But, you know, Dez Bryant's athleticism, his catching radius, his ability to leap for the ball, all those things I think are unquestioned. It's whether he can be a mature football player and develop, especially in what could be an explosive situation in Dallas. Now, the good thing is they've got a number one tight end. They've got a number one receiver in Miles Austin. Tony Romo throws the ball a lot. A lot is not expected of him right away, but he could push Roy Williams. So, you know, look, I mean, they've given him Drew Pearson's and Michael Irvin's number 88. There's a lot in his face right now. So whether he can handle that and perform is another question.
Well, and if you love the game and follow the game, you've heard the off-the-field questions, the difficult upbringing, the questions about his maturity. But what I'm kind of focused on is he didn't work out all that well physically prior to the draft. There were concerns about the foot. And so now for Wade Phillips to make this huge leap of the best young player he's ever seen, obviously he's seeing something that a lot of scouts and coaches didn't.
Yeah, and he sprained his ankle at the conclusion of the mini camp. That obviously wasn't a big concern. Phillips kind of brushed that aside. The pre-draft workout, you know, he was wearing a brand new pair of shoes that he had just gotten. I think a lot of people thought, well, why aren't you wearing a broken in pair of shoes? But you look at the college tape, 27 games, 29 career touchdowns. It's almost unfathomable what he did at Oklahoma State. So there's clearly a lot of untapped potential there.
All right, thank you very much, Eric. We now bring in Associate Editor Dan Parr, and Dan covers the New Orleans Saints. And Dan, big news out of New Orleans earlier this week. Alleged by a former member of their security staff, coaches stealing was the word, prescription painkillers, Vicodin, from the team's supply, distributing them to other members of the coaching staff and the ball club. Sean Payton has spoken out clearly and quickly. He's never taken, never abused them, never used them. But this appears to be just the beginning of this story.
Yeah, we don't know when there'll be a conclusion to this, and it's probably a long way away. So it's going to be a distraction for the Saints. When they head into training camp, this will probably be a story. Throughout the season, it could be a story. As you mentioned, Jeffrey Santini, who was the Saints' security director, has filed this lawsuit, and 130 Vicodin tablets are kind of in question right now as they went missing. It's going to be investigated, and there could be some interesting outcome for this investigation.
And let me be clear, Dan, there are no allegations against Sean Payton as being involved, but his response when the story broke was to make it clear that he's never used them. He doesn't know anything about it. He doesn't think it's true.
Well, he's been, it came out that he is senior staff member A in this lawsuit. The other member of the staff that was apparently senior staff member B is Joe Vitt, who is the assistant head coach and linebackers coach in New Orleans. Joe Vitt apparently had a medical condition. That's what reports indicate. Sean Payton did not. So that's where it stands right now.
Right, and we should be clear, when you file a suit, you go for the deepest pockets, and that would be Sean Payton on that coaching staff. So we will wait for the story to develop. We have no additional information beyond that. One other club on your radar, the Oakland Raiders, and we're all trying to figure out, is the trade for Jason Campbell the end for Jamarcus Russell in Oakland? That's what everybody assumed, but now minicamp is over. He's still there. There was one report that Tom Cable may have indicated that they could see Jason Campbell as a bit of a mentor for Jamarcus Russell, which makes little or no sense. There continue to be reports that he won't be a Raider come training camp. Anything new we can add to that?
Well, he did participate in that minicamp, and he apparently looked worse as the weekend went on. He started off very sharp. People were impressed with how he looked. And by the end of the weekend, he looked kind of a little closer to what we had been used to seeing from Jamarcus. He's apparently in shape. Tom Cable said he's been working his tail off, which is a positive development for him. But we know whose decision this is going to be. It's going to be Al Davis. He has yet to rule, I guess, and Jamarcus Russell is a Raider now.
Well, and based on his performance the first 3 years, there was a significant tail to work off. So we will see what kind of shape Jamarcus Russell is in when training camps open and where he is at. That's going to do it for the moment. We take another quick commercial break here, though, and a lot more NFL Way We Hear It coming up after this. We continue to make our way around the NFL with more Way We Hear It, all the news scoops and rumors before they happen right here on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News, and we welcome in Executive Editor Dan Arkush. Dan, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Arizona Cardinals, which is a ball club that you cover, but just quickly, a story that you picked up on out of St. Louis. Sam Bradford, a little unusual in that he is one of the first overall number one picks in the last 10, 12 years that was not signed, or at least a significant effort to sign him wasn't made prior to the draft. And you're hearing now that may not be imminent, maybe even negotiations not so imminent?
Right. The whole Ram organization is just operating extremely carefully financially right now, Hub, because the ownership situation is so uncertain. And, one thing that we're actually hearing that might be holding back any kind of a deal for Bradford is the possibility in the Rams' minds that, maybe by the end of the summer there could be a new labor deal with a rookie wage scale, which would obviously cut the price way down. Now that's a pretty, that's just a rumor, and a lot of things have to happen. We know just how volatile that whole contract situation is, but they do not seem to be in a real hurry to get Bradford signed, sealed, and delivered.
Well, certainly you can wait a couple weeks and see what happens, but boy, if they get a CBA prior to next spring, it will stun everybody. So we assume that negotiations will start in earnest sometime in the next few weeks or month or two. In Arizona, we talked to Eric Edholm a little while ago about the Philadelphia Eagles, arguably the team in the greatest transition in the NFL right now, 1 year removed or one season or one offseason removed from the first round of the playoffs and their exit there. Arizona Cardinals are 1 year, two seasons removed from a Super Bowl trip, and last year the second round of the playoffs, and yet clearly their MVP, Kurt Warner, is gone, retired now. I'd have to argue their MVP on defense, Carlos Dansby, is gone via free agency, as is their Pro Bowl safety, Antrell Roll, and yet this is a ball club that, at least from what you hear with Ken Whisenhunt, seems to think that they're still a contender.
Yeah, and Whisenhunt is the key. I mean, I think he's done as good a job as anybody in the NFL. The Cardinals have improved every year under his direction. And both him and Rod Graves, the GM, received well-deserved new deals, 4-year extensions just before the combine. But, Hub, this year Whisenhunt's going to have to earn every penny because, as you said, the losses on both sides of the ball, I mean, obviously the difference between Warner and Leinart is huge, but really defensively, Carlos Dansby, I mean, he was a good player, very good, and the leading tackler, and was a key in that defense. And right now, they're banking on second round pick Darrell Washington being the guy to replace him. And so, it's going to be really interesting to see.
All right, Dan, thank you very much. And we should point out Matt Leinart, maybe better God-given gifts to play the position than Kurt Warner, but has shown none of that as it relates to the NFL in his first few years in the league. So a big gamble in Arizona. Mike Wilkening, in addition to co-hosting with me every week, covers the AFC North. And in Cincinnati, Mike, I at some point I don't get it anymore. This team, they go out of their way to take risks where you would think they don't have to. They have probably the best pair of young cornerbacks in the NFL, and yet you're hearing the signing of Adam Pac-Man Jones could be imminent.
Well, Hub, indeed that appears to be the case, with multiple reports indicating that Pac-Man Jones is likely to sign with Cincinnati and return to the NFL. Now, Pac-Man, as we know, out of the NFL in 2009, was last in the NFL with Dallas in 2008. Certainly his history of off-field issues is well known as well. He's going to follow the personal conduct policy. At his best, certainly has starter caliber talent as a corner, at least he did earlier in his career. But the big question is, A, being away from the league two of the last 3 years, we have to wonder what he's got left. And B, obviously the big question is, this is someone that has run into trouble before and certainly has squandered a good deal of potential already in his career. So this is certainly one of the more interesting signings of the offseason if it's consummated. And I think all eyes again are on Cincinnati to kind of see how this relationship works out.
Well, and Mike, very quickly, it's clearly to be a backup role player. I mean, maybe as a punt returner and a nickelback, but he's not going to take playing time away from Leon Hall or Jonathan Joseph.
No, I think that's a good point to mention, Hub. I mean, Leon Hall, one of the best corners in the game. Jonathan Joseph, certainly in the team picture as well. You know, maybe he's a nickel corner. You know, he could compete to return punts and return kicks, but you've got to look at his numbers in Dallas in just kind of a small sample size. Didn't do a particularly great job returning punts, only a 4.5-yard average. So, you know, it's maybe not a slam dunk he wins that job necessarily either.
Thank you, Mike. We take one more quick commercial break here. We are back with more in the Publisher's Pen right on the other side.
The Publisher's Pen with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkush.
Mike, thank you much. And you know, it's a fascinating time in the National Basketball Association right now, not only with a very compelling round two of the 2009-2010 playoffs, but teams looking forward, teams in the playoffs looking forward, and people, as they have been for a year or two now, jockeying for position in this year's and next year's group of free agents. And it starts in Cleveland and Chicago. We talked a little bit with Tom Withers of the Associated Press a while ago, not only about the pressure on LeBron James to overcome his nagging elbow problems, but to take his team further than they've ever gone before, which last year was just the conference finals. Can they get further? And if they don't even get that far, what does it do to the chances of LeBron James staying in Cleveland? Then we move to Chicago, the third largest market in the country and in the NBA, where Vinny Del Negro has been fired and Gar Forman, the GM, said earlier this week, there's no rush to hire a coach. We may not even have one by the time free agency rolls around. Well, the Bulls see themselves as a player for LeBron James, or short of that, a Dwayne Wade, or maybe a Stoudemire or a Nowitzki if they opt out of their contracts. But certainly not without a coach. And so as we watch the rest of these playoffs, we need to watch very closely in Chicago and Philadelphia as well. The 2010-2011 season is already taking shape. That does it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. Our thanks to Tom Withers of the Associated Press out of Cleveland. Steve Kyler joined us again from HoopsWorld.com. Randy Myers does such a great job for us every week producing and engineering. Syndication Networks is our home studio and syndicator. And most of all, our thanks to all of you. You make the show. We appreciate your listening. Please stay tuned again next week, same time, same station, for more of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.